disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give up.
Greetings, friends, clients, family members, and random stray listeners. This is Jack Tuckner with Deborah Orell. And boy, is it precarious out there, don't you think?
It is.
Hot and precarious. But we at the Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocates Office don't give up, and you can't give up either.
And so, don't quit.
And do not quit your job. You know why we say that? That's our hashtag don't quit. Hashtag don't quit. We're going to have that go. It should go viral because we have a problem in the world of employment issues in this country where people, and it's sort of in human nature, people get fed up, they get sick and tired of their job, and they say, I quit, and they tell their boss where to get off, and they wait, and they wait, and they wait till it can't, you know, not everyone, their relatives say, your husband says, quit, what are you doing, it's driving you crazy, you're losing your hair, and then they call a lawyer, and the problem is when you quit, what do you do, what happens, Deb?
Well, in pregnancy, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, that's a good one. But that's like throwing the baby out of the bathwater with every type of discrimination,
yes,
right?
Particularly.
That's an apt
apropos
metaphor. But yes, that's what happens. You do not have a case if you quit. So, I mean, actually, we'll be talking today a little bit about a case that the plaintiff did quit, is the Price Waterhouse case, one of the first cases that went to the Supreme Court, sex discrimination case. Fascinating, because it was only a few years ago, and we'll chat about that. And that was a so-called constructive discharge case where the plaintiff quit because she couldn't take it anymore, and they were really driving her out. And that's what you have to prove, that it was so bad that no similarly situated human being who's standing in your shoes in this workplace could have possibly stayed there, and they would have, you know, run screaming into the night. So it's a very high burden. So don't quit. So we have in the next few weeks, just want to give you a little heads up, we have a bunch of exciting shows coming up. Today we're going to be chatting, Deborah and I, about, you know, the basic foundations of employment law again, and gender discrimination, and what maketh a case and what doesn't, and how you can empower yourself to make sure that if you are experiencing hostility in the workplace, so-called severely hostile work environment, people throw that phrase around, but it doesn't really mean a whole lot in and of itself, because many of us work in hostile work environments that just aren't covered under the law because our boss is a schmuck, or they're mean or not nice, you work with your family and so crazy. And there isn't a whole lot you could do about it but find a position or a job somewhere that doesn't drive you crazy and that fulfills your, you know, creative needs or your need to, you know, grow professionally and personally. But the real severely hostile work environment is based on something about you that the law protects. And again, something about you is not that you're finicky or that you're too tall or that, you know, you could fill in the blank with any number of issues that your employer doesn't like about you, but they're not covered. So, you know, the normal categories that people know about, I think, just from living in our culture, race, color, ethnicity, national origin, age, religion, disability, alienage, gender, sex under federal law, often called gender under state law. And in certain city, like in our New York City, we have gender and, of course, gender identity as also a variant, which is, of course, not covered under federal law, and nor is sexual orientation yet, right, believe it or not, under federal law. So today, though, we wanted to, at some point, also chat about an area of the law as it pertains to women and discrimination that doesn't come up very often, and most people don't really talk about. In fact, if you enter this phrase on Twitter, for instance, you're going to get about four, you know, results. There's not much talk about it at all, and that issue is so-called sex plus discrimination, sex hyphen plus discrimination. That is your sex, and your sex is almost always, in the case of these types of situations, female, plus another factor that is being used in conjunction with that against you in the workplace by your employer. So, for instance, your gender and the fact that you have small, young children at home. And if your employer treats women who don't have young children at home differently than you as a female, or you as a female of a certain age, a woman who's 50-something years old, and the employer treats not only, it's not that they treat men differently and not that they treat women differently in general, but that they treat younger women differently than you. And that shows how, again, significant and pervasive sex is in our culture in terms of a discriminatory factor, that there's often an insidious secondary component that will screw you if the first doesn't. And again, right. When it comes to children, we could talk about this, the original case that the Supreme Court looked at was exactly that situation where it was a female. In fact, they weren't hiring. There was like it used to be. You know, blacks need not apply, not that long ago. This was, and I think it was, I'll find the minute I had it in front of me, Marietta Company versus, I forgot the name of it for the moment. But it was, see if you have it right there. But the corporation said and did for years say, we will not hire women with small children. They didn't, of course, ask whether men had small children because it was irrelevant. It was irrelevant because the presumption was it's not going to matter whether he has small children or grown children or no children because the boy's going to show up for work. So it was sort of that double standard that the court ultimately, knocked down. And this cause of action comes up. We just today, June, whatever it is, 9th, 2014, in our office had a call from a woman who said that I am being treated differently, discriminated against. It's also known as disparate treatment or differential treatment. Why? Because the place that I work does not... You tell it, Deb. You talk
to
her.
Yeah, well, just to tell you, it's Phillips v. Martin Marietta.
Exactly. Thank you.
So the call was a woman who said that the supervisor, manager of her place of employment basically said, this place is not a place for women with children, and pretty much systematically went after pregnant women, women with young children, and women, because women also are in that sandwich caregiving role with elder care, taking mm-hmm. care of elderly mm-hmm. parents, in-laws, etc. But this particular manager was really going after women with children. Mm-hmm. So while women with children is not in and of itself a protected status, being a mother is not a protected status, that's where the sex plus. So there clearly was different treatment for women without children.
Right.
So that's, what kind of brought around this whole sort of topic about, well, what about when you're treated differently? Hiring decisions, when you're not hired because, and sex mm-hmm. plus also, and I'm not a lawyer, I just play one at work, but mm-hmm. sex plus also covers women if the manager of the hiring person thinks that because you're newly married, you're probably going to have kids right away, mm-hmm. Because you waited until you were 38 to get married, you're probably going to start right away, so why hire you? So even the intimation in mm-hmm. The interview process, women will hide their wedding rings.
Right.
Just because they're not usually outright asked, are you planning to have children? But this way, there's no ring, there's no conversation about it. But Sex Plus, there was some case with she didn't get the job because the hiring, they didn't want someone who was going to be out because right away they're going to be the assumption was made.
Right.
And there was a case that found for that, right?
Right. Well, the assumptions are still made, of course, today, every day, in hiring women of childbearing age. So after college, and certainly women in their prime childbearing ages in their 30s, employers often rightly assume that, especially if you're married, and that you're going to probably start banging out some babies. And they take that into account, unlike they would with men, which the questions that they used to ask at interviews, which they still do, but, you know, the smart ones don't anymore and find other ways around it, asking, you have a family, are you planning on what's your, you know, don't, those questions of are you having children, do you have children, will you plan on...
How are you going to manage this workload? Like the, right, the right. There was a cop in right. some city mm-hmm. who... 5 years, unblemished record, adopts a child, and now all of a sudden they're saying, how are you going to manage this increased right. workload? How are you going to handle this?
Exactly. Well,
and she didn't get the promotion.
She didn't get the promotion. Well, I mean, again, it's still, it happens every day. It's just a little more insidious than it used to be in the not-too-distant past. You know, the one case, and I don't know if you're referring to this one, but the you have too much on your plate case, or
yeah.
those types of cases where, in fact, in this particular case, Chadwick versus Wellpoint, a working mother was denied a promotion because she had too much on her plate. And what the Circuit Court of Appeals in finding for her, because they held that this was in fact sex discrimination.
Right.
But what the employer said to her was, her manager, who failed to promote her for a job that she was clearly sort of a shoe-in for, said it has nothing to do with what you did or didn't do. It was just that you're going to school. She had taken some A1 class at night. You're going to school, you have the kids, and you just have a lot on your plate right now. Boom. Now the lower court said, you know, what's wrong with that? But again, as some courts that are still awakening held that, hello, that was not a question, number one, that you would ask probably to a man.
Right.
Clearly. And you wouldn't tell a man he has too much on his plate because he has kids.
I don't think
ever. Like in the history
ever.
Of, like, humankind.
Exactly.
No one has ever said to a man, how many kids do you have and isn't that going to be a lot of work? That's what I got my stay-at-home wife for.
Right.
Or my full-time working wife who still comes home because presumably she makes, you know, I'm the alpha male, she makes less money than me, and sort of the way, the framework that is now... More often than not the case, of course, in our crazy culture, but that was the assumption. Or you'll
except
have a babysitter, an au pair, except for the 1% of the 0.1%, of course, that's true. Good distinction. But really, for the rest of us, like working, you know, drones and the masses of us, including those of us who make, you know, sort of a decent living, but are nowhere near what, you know, the economic royalists make and the air that they breathe, it's a completely different, you know, planet. And we still, women still, of course, face discriminatory animus, you know, regularly. I did want to mention that because I revisited it earlier today when I was looking at the history of sort of sex discrimination claims. A case in 1989 that a lot of people have heard of, even if they are not lawyers or in the law, it was called Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins. And it was, I just want to see, first of all, before I find that, I just want to read, thank you very much, I just wanted to read here's the official sex plus discrimination description, definition. Sex plus discrimination refers to discrimination against one gender that possesses certain qualities. I'm sorry, there's a legalese in here now. Okay, here's a way that it was described by one of the judges. To be actionable, gender plus or sex plus discrimination must be premised on gender. As one scholar has artfully explained, Title VII, which is the Civil Rights Act, that the federal law that we bring these types of claims under for sex discrimination, contemplates sex plus claims because when one proceeds to cancel out the common characteristics of the two classes being compared, for example, married men and married women, as one would do in solving an algebraic equation, the canceled out element proves to be that of married status, and sex remains the only operative factor in the equation, which of course would be the same whether or not it was married men or unmarried women with children and men with children, or women with children and women without children. In other words, what's the one factor or combination of factors that creates the disparate treatment? And again, mm-hmm. here it's sort of sex plus children. But prior to that, very interesting, this was only 1982. A woman named Ann Hopkins was working at one of the so-called Big Eight, I think they're now Big Four accounting firms, but at the time was Big Eight accounting firm, Price Waterhouse. And she was, according to everyone, the natural choice for this particular promotion. There were 88 candidates, all male. All the others were male except for her. And she had the best record in the firm at generating new business, securing multi-million dollar contracts for this firm, etc. But her nomination, again, in the 80s, was put on hold after she was evaluated by several male partners as being too macho, quote-unquote macho, and in need of a, quote, charm school, unquote. One of her senior partners asked her to, quote, walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have her hair styled, and wear jewelry. Instead, she quit the firm and filed a lawsuit under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which forbids employment discrimination because of a person's sex. Now, this was, she quit after a couple of years of not, I'll add, of not being promoted and of having all of these, there were far more details of how they all treated her. There were comments that she was, or allusions to the fact that her sexual orientation was in question because of the way she carried herself, that she was too aggressive. But it was conceded that that type of aggressivity that brought business in and was kicking butt and taking names was exactly what they would be looking for in a boy.
Right.
It was just that, see, women have to somehow figure out how to do it all and be coquettish at the same time and want men to still want to sleep with you, and they still have to see, you know, sexualize you while you're still doing it all. That's a neat trick, right? I mean, for the few women that have still to this day, because it's better than it has ever been. But I'm sure that the women, and I'm sure we'll bring someone on and find out. But anytime we interview or we speak with or know someone who has, again, perhaps not the 1%, perhaps we're not talking about who is the Hewlett-Packard CEO or people that have made it to the, do you remember her name?
Oh, Meg.
Yeah, was that Whitman? I don't remember who's who. That. Not her. But whoever was the CEO of HP for many years, you know.
Oh, ran for governor.
Right, but that's not even who I'm thinking about. But either way, there's no shortage these days, or you could certainly pick out women who, you know, are at the top of their respective food chains. But I would, you know, I'm sure that they will tell their tale about how it was exceedingly challenging and different than it would have been if they were a guy, because of, you know, clearly different standards that are not built into anything organic or immutable or biblical or, you know, biological.
Carly Fiorino.
Yes. You know, who has also had a lot of masculine traits, and, you know, I don't know her story of how she, you know, how she scaled those great heights. But all of this is still relatively new, and women are definitely held to a different standard. So, I mean, here, the Supreme Court, in this case, Ann Hopkins versus Price Waterhouse, where she ultimately was constructively discharged, meaning that they said, get out of here, you're as good as fired, didn't allow her to make partner. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, listen, this happens to people of color. If you look at the film Philadelphia that told the story also in the 80s, Tom Hanks famously played the part, true story, of a lawyer who was gay, who was hiding the fact that he was gay because he was in a law firm with a bunch of white male, you know, privileged, you know, homophobes, basically, all heterosexual. And when they found out that he was gay, which they found out because he was ill with AIDS, but it was all of a piece, he also didn't make partner, and they would look at him. I don't remember whether they all but fired him as he was dying.
Yeah.
And that was...
Well, they tried to blame it on some error,
but
they basically set him up,
right,
yeah.
Sure. So, you know, it has been... But you know what? I thought, Deborah, you know, as I was mentioning before, and then we could talk about... I just thought it was just fascinating that when we talk about this sort of trajectory of, you know, women's rights in the workplace, or just women's rights in our culture, or women's rights in the world, at least in the recent past, since the feminine principle has been so devalued, and I'm going just back a couple few thousands of years, where I don't think women, from my understanding, is women weren't always as a gender in our species so devalued, so second classed out.
When? What are you
like? I'm talking about sort of you know,
we only just got the vote, and that was only because a few men said you could have the vote.
I'm going way back. I'm talking maybe sort of the prehistorical, pre-religious, I don't know how many millennia, but there was a time when humans were still walking upright, where my understanding is women were revered, when the goddesses, female goddesses were revered, and even in some cultures where, you know, Mary is a much greater iconic symbol than even Jesus, and they love her.
Yes.
And originally I think it was the Father, the Son, and the Mother, not, you know, the Holy Ghost. And there was a whole, you know, so the women were, it was understood. I think there was an intrinsic understanding, the way you would think that, I always wonder why when no matter how dumb we are, I always say when you hear of a story of, I often think of it myself, even when construction workers are harassed, street harassment, when they're harassing, and, you know, you hear and read these stories every day, and we see it, that type of violative, you know, degrading harassment. I always think to myself, all these fucking guys have sisters, mothers, daughters, wives. I mean, they all know one, and if it was theirs. And I never understand, there's almost a sociopathic unwillingness to sort of say, hey, like, I don't know what that is. You know, hey, asshole, like, why aren't you identifying that woman who looks distressed when you're saying to her, hey, why walking so fast, honey? What's up with your nice ass? Why is it you're not able to
make the connection that this could be your sister, wife, mother.
Right. It's called empathy. But I'm saying, even just have empathy and saying, well, why would you? She feels bad. You're making her feel bad.
But that's what it's about.
I know, but you just, again, these men, and if there is that sort of, whether it's culturally inculcated, the misogyny, there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
And that's what I was also saying in reading over the weekend, that there have been an unusually large number of female judges lately, and I just tweeted out one of these cases, but there were three in the last couple of months where women, female judges, sentenced rapists, it wasn't even like questionable date rapes, rapists, like rapists of children, rapists, you know, of violent rapists, to crazily, lenient sentences, including probation, suspended sentences, and the idea is that, you know, I believe the rationale was, well, he doesn't have a criminal record, or he's a white guy, or he's not a back alley rapist, he's not a black guy, he's whatever it is, that they find a reason to devalue the victim and to let the perpetrator off. And because they're females, I'm just, you know, this doesn't take a rocket scientist or a social scientist to see that it's not just, the misogyny is not just built into our sons that we raise or have, you know, too many Girls Gone Wild or beer commercials, although it's all part of it. It's got to be our sick culture. The malady is because, again, even female judges are doing it just like male judges. So it's sort of, it's baked into the cake at this
point.
Well,
just like when we had David Yamada on about workplace bullying.
Right.
Women bully women.
Right.
Men bully women. It is part of inculcation and part of a culture. But going back to what you were saying about the origins, if you look at and study any of the shamanic teachings, all the indigenous populations, which were of almost all people of color, and just using maybe the Aborigines or Native Americans when they finally got to this continent, it was Mother Nature that ruled, not Father, whatever the hell it is. It was Mother Nature that revered. This is the giver of life. And this is the, you know, the shorter version of it, but what ended up happening was we got away from nature. We actually discovered agriculture. And with the discovery of agriculture, we then could shift where we lived. We had control. I have food, you don't. And that's what began to tap into, let's say, our lower selves, but also about power and control. And this is where males tended to take over. You know, protection. We weren't really hunter or gatherers. We were scavengers. Whatever was there is what we ate. And then over time, to gain control, it was no longer about nature. Religions were formed. Because when you look at the ancient Egypt, the pharaohs ate meat. They ate, you know, a lot of proteins. It was the pyramid builders who were eating grain because that's what they could grow right here to keep them working. And it wasn't as much trouble to bring meat so that there was less of it for the pharaohs. So therefore, it already started that distinction. So, you know, for lack of a better phrase, shit flows down. So therefore, men in the pyramid builders needed somebody that they could abuse or take on. And it's all about this power thing. So religions get created. This is what God, you know, whatever the God was, wants you to do. And that was all about power. So that the ruling class, be it the pharaohs, be it the Roman Catholic Church, whatever it was, they could begin to control people, control money, and this all tapped into our lower selves. So in a way, this is about controlling people of color, people of women, that somehow, you know, men evolved as the ruling class, and any threat to that power they created controls over. Which is why, even looking in the evolution of, we were reading somewhere, Queen for a Day, in some of this research.
Well, I wanted to talk about that, yeah.
I remember being, six, seven, 8 years old, right, watching, you know, the black and white TV, Queen for a Day,
right,
and thinking how great.
How sick it was. You were thinking how great it was at the time?
Well, but at the time,
because,
you know, it was because it was pulling on heartstrings,
right,
and what do I know as
a
kid?
Right.
But I just remember my mother was the only woman on the block who worked. She left every morning driving off in her red convertible because she wasn't going to stay home. And all of the other mothers talked about her, you know, she's one of the O'Rell kids. There's nobody home taking care of them.
Right.
And we were looked at differently, which is partly why I think we moved around a lot, because my mother got pissed off at everybody.
Right.
But that's where it came from. We really started with Mother Nature was ruling, because this is the giver of life. This is part of that evolution, and that's how far off we've come now. People of color rule the planet, except somehow male Caucasians.
You mean rule? You mean
population-wise?
Population. Mm-hmm.
Except male Caucasians have this perception that they're in charge, and the more that they are losing a grasp on it, that's where the oppressive laws and protections are coming in, because they it's slipping through their fingers.
Well, nice rant there, Debbie.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly it's all tied in, because I'd say now the greater ill, although I suppose it's infused with this sort of male imperative, this sort of what has become this kind of testosterone overload and overlording it. Over the planet and all things in it, the factory farming that came with the agricultural inventions. Listen, the fact that I wanted to talk about this because, you know, I don't remember who said something about, you know, once we forget, once the last person dies off, you know, when any event happens, like whether it was the Great Depression or the Second World War, we forget. The great forgetting happens, and we all repeat it. And as, you know, those who, you know, forget are doomed to repeat
exactly
the mistakes of the past, and we're doing it all again now. And I just, this came up, I was listening to the Tom Hartman show, which everyone should listen to. It's a brilliant, progressive talk show host, found everywhere on the dial. You could just, you know, Google Tom Hartman. And he had on a guest last week talking about, who's an author whose name eludes me, but it was about the fact that we went to war in World War II, which at the time was, of course, a popular undertaking. It was to champion the four freedoms. The four freedoms were everyone at the time, every soldier, every commoner knew what that meant, what they were. I didn't know today. I had forgotten. I'd heard the phrase. But the two that we all forget about are the four freedoms. was the freedom from want and the freedom from fear. And as FDR said at some point, and I'm paraphrasing badly, that a necessitous man is not a free man. And, I mean, that stuff, you think about that. A necessitous man, of course, the word for the time using that word for person, a necessitous person, meaning someone in need, food, shelter, medical care, is not really free. And that he then proposed, after the war, this is FDR, the second Bill of Rights that had in it, within it, the right to a job. The right, and this is to a job that pays a living wage. So it wouldn't be a job like in the fast food industry in our country and in Walmart, the two biggest employers of low-wage folks. Again, we subsidize, in fact, I heard this the other day, we subsidize every Walmart store to the tune of $1 million a year.
Yes.
So just because we're paying all the rest of the food stamps to their $7.25 employees that aren't making a living wage, which is just an outrageous business model that came about at the time, you know, again, it started with the Reagan corporate counter-revolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I may have read the same article this weekend for Walmart, and I think it came out to be something like for Walmart to raise the minimum wage to either $9 or $10, I forget, it would add one penny
right
to the cost of the products in the store. And if they just raised it 1 cent, they could raise everybody's salary.
And what's also, what's so built in sick
about
it.
I mean, that's how really sick it is.
Well, but beside the just the ethical argument, the morality of it all, that, you know, again, the Walmart family, the richest family in the planet, you know, what I would eat.
And I don't, listen, richest family, I don't deprive anybody,
well,
you know.
Yeah, me neither.
Okay, but it's
enjoy.
Just not at the expense. And this is what all of the economists now are really talking, you know, my Nobel Prize there guy.
Paul Krugman.
Oh, yeah, love him. And Stiglitz now, I really love him. That corporations have a responsibility to pay back. And it's not just writing a check to Salvation Army or the, you know, cancer research or things like that, but
right,
they have a responsibility to the communities that they are in, to the government that provides them the corporate welfare.
Right.
And what's happened is shareholder value has taken
right
over.
But that's sick.
But yeah,
but beyond the morality of the fact that here you have, you know, in the Walmarts again with their, you know, I think there's 12 of them with their, you know, many billions of dollars, again, they could enjoy that. The fact is, forget about paying their, I mean, they're not paying taxes. They're not paying their fair share. They're you know, stashing it in Swiss banks and in the Cayman Islands, and they're not paying their employees, so that the employees, here's the rub, the employees could spend the money in our culture.
Right.
There'd be demand
in the Walmart.
In the Walmart, but in the world, so that we would all, that's how the ships rise. I mean, this
right
is, again, Econ 101. All the rest of it is bullshit. All the rest of it, the idea that austerity is the way out, whether it's in Europe now, it's, you know, it was
that
clear.
That didn't work.
Well, it never has worked, and no country in the history of the world has ever cut its way to prosperity. A country is not a family budget. It's not. We make the money. After World War II, we were far greater in debt as a function of debt to GDP, the ratio.
Yes.
I think we're 150% debt, GDP. We grew our way to prosperity from FDR and Eisenhower of building. What did we do?
And
we
what
said,
was
you
know, the tax rate then? 92%?
Well, it was something like 91%. But again, on incomes, even today, I mean, those, but relatively speaking, those were like on incomes over $100 million. It was
right
like equivalent to, you know, it wasn't like, oh, they're going to tax me. I make $90,000 a year. They're trying to take my money.
No,
and people,
that was the upper.
Right.
Right.
Well, but I mean, it was, so the fact is that, and by doing so, and of course, today, do we need it? We need it more than we did after World War II. The idea that building our infrastructure, our bridges, our highways, our water,
being able to take care of the veterans
how about
who
that
just
right
come
right
through
right
X number of wars
right
here.
Right.
The Vietnam vets have never gotten right the treatment that they required.
So I guess it goes hand in glove. The whole idea, we're talking about sort of this misogynistic or sort of male, egoic, crazy, the current sort of environment, that sort of Tea Party, corporate-backed Koch brothers, you know, we've got the money, and now with the five crazies in the Supreme Court, you know, we've got these thugs, these gangsters, these majority on the Supreme Court. The top lawyers in the land, five of them, the Supreme Court judges, are, you know, madmen. They're just like robed thugs, and they have handed to the wealthy, the oligarchs, the corporations, the power to say, I've got, or Shelley Adelson, I got $100 million to spend on this person. What do you got? You know, every day we get emails from President Clinton and Michelle Obama, President Obama and Michelle Obama, and Democrat, I see we both get them every day asking for $5 or a dollar, or begging every minute of every day just to try to keep up, and of course we cannot. So there really isn't any more of it. It's really sad, and it pisses me off. There's no democracy as we knew it, even when we were young prior to the 80s. You can't compete with that kind of money. So it was a hollowed out culture. It's really
right. I just want to bring this back a little bit, though, because, you know, we could really go off on more of a tangent. So just to come full circle here, recently there was all of this discussion. I want to bring it back to discrimination.
Okay.
You know, specifically in the workplace, but discrimination in our society against women. I mean, that's which
right.
is our focus. But it's also, you know, it just feels so, maybe because we're in New York City, but against people of color. I mean, I just see it all over the place. And it's that unspoken but very, very felt. It's the woman who calls to say, you know, I don't have an email, I don't have a text, I don't have her on tape saying, I hate pregnant women, but, you know, mothers are treated differently. People of color will not work here. You know, that's at the core of what we're in business to help people, you know, and that's what I want to bring it back to. It's like, what are the laws that protect people? What can they do? Who is helping? How do you see it? What do you do when you feel it? You know, like this woman, she just said, I'm just telling you, you know, and then when this is how I'm feeling. This principal wants to get, you know, mothers out of this school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this is what I feel people of color, because when, you know, when people who are not getting promoted or not getting hired, you know, the guy who called, who had been through 9 phone interviews for some upper-level marketing position, and it wasn't until the final 3 interviews, which were face-to-face in one day, that where all these other calls, it was glowing, great, phenomenal, no problem, on to the next one.
But he'd be black.
And then he showed up, and all of a sudden, you know,
you're a black fella, ain't you?
Ooh, we didn't hear that over the phone.
Yeah, he spoke like a white man.
Yeah, and
yeah,
you know, that's still happening.
Of course it's still happening. But, I mean, whether it's so, yeah, well, welcome to, welcome to the United States and welcome to America. I mean, this is our, whether it's women, people of color, you know, the LGBTQ community,
exactly.
Of course. So, you know, what sort of minority status puts you sort of in the equivalent footing of, you know, sort of white male privilege other than white male privilege? I mean, none. I mean, certainly having you as a woman, you don't have male privilege, but you have, you know, white privilege. And you know,
right.
Then, which is why when we look at the equal pay stats, who's at the bottom?
Right.
The very bottom.
Women of color.
Women of color.
Right.
Maybe Latina, I think, like still a click below.
A click, just a hair, because of the language.
Right. We're often perceived as when it is a language issue. Yeah. So, of course. But so, I mean, that's seems to be a given. We've been kind of, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, because while we've been going forward, you know, on the one hand, there's been progress. No one, you know, again, I would still love to, we'll just read for those of
I just had this thought.
Yeah.
Okay, that a point that I wanted to bring up before you go off.
Yeah.
Okay, so I went to this history of sexual harassment that Now, I think it was Now in the City, did a couple of weeks ago. And they mostly talked about street harassment and, you know, what's happening mostly in New York City, because that's where we are, but internationally, et cetera. So this sense of entitlement that men feel when a woman is walking down the street, as if she should feel really good that, you know, he thinks that he has determined that she's good looking.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, there's something about her that's really attractive or appealing, or, you know, that whole kind of thing. And it's this sense of entitlement that they feel. So at the same time, when studies have been done, and I wish I had all these figures in front of me, but men learn most of their information about sex through porn. And the more porn they're exposed to, the more they come to expect women to present themselves as just having this insatiable sexual appetite just for them. Like the shooter last week. He shot up everybody because he felt that women, that he was entitled to be having sex and be dating and be going out with all of these attractive women, that it was his sense of entitlement. So that the level of advertising that women's bodies are used to sell products, it ratchets up what men expect, which is why our younger daughters, women in their 20s now, the men in their 20s are different than they were, say, when I was 20. You know, it's just ratcheted up.
A worse?
Yeah, because, but in the same way, you know, in the same way that women's rights have grown, you know, racial freedoms and, you know, expectations have grown, so has, you know, the negative part of it.
Well, and then I think that's true that, It's sort of like you hear some spiritual teachers talk about right now. We're going through an actual speeding up of the sort of insanity right now. I mean, way speeding up. If you look at the 20th century, right, never before with technology allowing us to be way more mad than we've ever been. You know, Winston Churchill famously said his definition of history was one damn thing after another. And now if you look at the 20th century, that one damn thing after another caused the death of about 150 million people at our own hands. And it's continuing right into the 21st century. So that in a way that's building climate denial, climate change,
right,
again, 100,
yeah.
I mean, we'll probably, it's kind of game over the way we think it has been going.
Right.
Some point in the near
future.
There
are countries running out of water.
Yeah, and we're going to be running out of food and water. And again, this seems to be, again, this is, we're all a little bit in denial, but not in question, except the corporate media barely ever talks about it because it doesn't serve them. But that, and again, just the nuclear, you know, that we have, that they apparently can't find however many nuclear warheads, that were sort of the detritus from the old Soviet Union is somewhere, and all it will take is one plutonium bomb the size of a man's fist in a suitcase to take out Manhattan. I mean, there's a lot of ways that it could really we're going in the wrong direction. But at the same time, there seems to be, you know, sort of a growing awakening, people realizing to a certain extent, not that many and not a critical mass yet, but that we are insane and that we do have to change and that we one day probably will be less sort of driven by our crazy kind of Klingon like, you know, male-dominated thinking and us versus them, and more and more and more, and learn to live like every other creature does on the planet before the planet just shakes us off. We're not that important, right? So I think that, you know, you're right in that in some ways you could see it sort of, it seems to be getting worse while it's getting better, because at least our daughters can, we could say to our children these days, you could be whatever you want to be to a certain extent. You could be, you know, nuclear, you could go to MIT, you could be a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, a judge, or the president potentially. We say that these days. So it's also that kind of mixed.
Right.
But
when it comes to those issues of power, though, that sexual power, that's where it gets a little dicey.
Sexual power?
Well, you know, that energy.
Yeah.
About control and power.
Yeah.
And that's where men still act like jerks when women walk down the street. I mean, if that just in and of itself is...
Well, we all need to, you know, it's kind of like hashtag I holla back, you know.
Yeah.
There's like, there's that, and I've also, I read and tweeted it the other day, and I forgot, I really wish I had written down, but we weren't, unfortunately, this show was supposed to be something else today. A great article on street harassment, and what we should all be doing, men, women who see it, because every time someone does, you know, that construction worker, and normally it's sort of pack behavior, and that can be most of the time, the number of things one should do, and not, you know, in talking back to it and saying what it is and the steps that they say we should take, you know, ultimately would have, you know, we would sort of shame this particular gender, even that particular demographic, into not doing it anymore. But we as a culture kind of walk, it's just another, because what are you supposed to do? It's 10 construction workers,
well,
right?
You can say all you want, but then they plaster, you know, Heineken all over a woman's body where she's, you know, naked except for the word Heineken across her private parts. Women's bodies sell product.
Okay, but we do that. So what I'm saying is a culture, but we do it. We have the most popular show ever is Mad Men, and we all say, well, that was another time, and I don't know, I don't watch the show, but I'm saying that if the idea was Mad Men was quaint and everybody smoked and drank and secretaries, and it was just like that at the time, and I assume everybody on that show, everybody, the protagonist, they're loved, and no one's really a bad person, but yet they're sexist, right? I mean, it's a sexist culture. More so than today, because it's so overt, is it not?
No, I think it's just as bad, only that was the role. It was much more role-driven. Women didn't have the opportunities in the 50s. Those women who were trying to, you know, break into marketing and advertising in the 50s had a hard time, and they had to sleep their way there. Now, it's just, you can get the jobs, but it's like it's unspoken. That's what creates that energy. That's what I'm saying, is that that's what women feel. It's that, and what I imagine people of color feel, that, listen, I know I'm not getting this job because of the color of my skin. I know I'm not getting this promotion because I have kids.
Right. Or what people of color say to themselves, I'm sure women do all the time, that men don't understand, and I certainly, is that, did that person say that to me just now?
Yes.
Because of the color of my skin? Well, almost like good or bad, but mostly not good. You know, did that happen to me? Did he not hold the door open for me? Or did they hold the door open for me? You know, there's always some, either as an ulterior motive, you're constantly questioning whether or not this sort of happened to me because I'm black, etc. So,
and that was actually one of the Sex Plus cases, too, that this woman, that they had a code word for discriminating against her, not just because she was of color, but because she was the angry black woman.
Right.
But they called her something else.
Right.
But it's that kind of a thing, that just because you get upset, you know, that you're stereotyped, you're pigeonholed in this way that you have no control over.
Right.
That someone's perception of what an Asian, what, you know, a person of color, what a woman is supposed to be doing.
Exactly.
And how do you break through that and fight against it, except to call it out? And that's what this show, that's what we use our time for, is to talk about bringing awareness. That feeling you had that you didn't get that job because you have kids, I honor that. I say respect that. That's your inner wisdom talking. You may not have a case, you may not have something, but check with a lawyer because you might be able to do something to protect yourself.
Right.
And it's each and every one of those times that someone has the courage, that they find the courage within them to stand up and say, this is not right.
Right. Nicely done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go Deb.
Yeah, we'll go Jack.
Well, I want to say this. I agree, 100%. And
as well, you should.
But you know, back to this sex stereotyping, because that's what really we were talking about. Sex stereotyping, which is what sex plus discrimination is, in a sense, or actually what it is. Back to the Price Waterhouse case from was decided in 1989 by the court, and again, it was the first time the court made a decision explicitly that something behavior like this in the Price Waterhouse Ann Hopkins case was sex discrimination. It was a 6-3 ruling. It was hailed by civil rights and women's advocates, and the Supreme Court based its decision, at least in part, on sexual stereotyping. William Brennan, the late great Justice William Brennan, you know, the lion, the liberal lion. Yes, I wish I had my. I got to start my noise machine. William Brennan was, you know, a stud, a progressive. You know, like he was the balls. He was the guy who on the bench. You know, just a total. He was a feminist. He was just a great jurist. What the Supreme Court should be comprised of. He issued the majority opinion 6-3 in favor of Ann Hopkins and against Price Waterhouse. Well, there were three dissenting opinions. They were, let me just see, wrote, and by the way, a great quote, William Brennan quote from the case is, quote, "An employer who objects to aggressiveness in women, but whose positions require this trait, places women in an intolerable and impermissible catch-22.
Yeah.
Out of a job if they behave aggressively, and out of a job if they don't." Bill Brennan. Very cool. Now, the Sandra Day O'Connor, who was, in fact, she was on the majority of the court, too. She was Republican and conservative, but, you know, with certain issues, she had a brain in her head. And unlike the five wackadoodle nuts today on the court, she helped decide this case in the right way for women. And the of the three, Justice Rehnquist, Scalia, Antonin Scalia, of course, was in the dissent, and I believe the other two, Rehnquist, and I don't remember. Oh, and Kennedy, who is still in all the 5-4 majority decisions that screw everybody, like Citizens United. Mm-hmm. Kennedy is with those five still. So today, she would have lost Ann Hopkins, and that's part of the, she would have lost because those five would have voted against her in a heartbeat. It was done.
And this is why I say it's not about who's president, it's about who's in control of the Supreme Court.
Well, that's what the president makes those.
That's why I'm saying. So it's not about you just want anybody who is on essentially your side.
Right. Well, which is why Romney, another thing, people would have been such an abortion.
Oh, my
almost
God.
Literally.
Well,
right,
there would have been no abortions.
Exactly. But you know what? We have a couple of minutes. I just was wondering if people, speaking about, you know, what we all don't know
and forget.
Yeah,
you want to talk about shows coming up?
Oh, I want to talk about shows coming up.
I do.
Time. Well, we only have a few minutes, but let me, we have a few minutes, 5 minutes. We have, very excited to tell you, we have, I don't know if I have the dates in front of me, but in the coming weeks, so we'll have promos up at prn.fm. Marianne Schnall, the founder of Feminist.com, who has written a book called What Will It Take to Make a Woman President, interviewed, I guess, many dozens of prominent women, about just that question. That was the question posed. What will it take to be a woman president? It's a terrific book. It's obtainable now on Amazon and your places elsewhere. People are trying to avoid shopping at Amazon, Powell Books. And she will be coming, joining us this month, I believe. We have Joy Murphy back with us next week, a personal coach, and we'll be talking about, you know, mostly some variant on how to deal with the pressures of our current you know, very sort of hot and challenging workplaces, and give us some tips on how to negotiate and just cope and self-care.
Yes.
We have Vanessa Merton, my favorite. I'm so looking forward to that. My former mentor and a professor of law she's an NYU law grad herself. She taught at the City University of New York, was my professor, and at now, thank you, and at Pace Law School, and she will be talking about a topic close to her heart, fraud on immigrants, about all the very nasty and dirty things we do to immigrants, and not to the, we don't have an immigrant problem, we have an illegal employer of immigrant problem.
Yes.
Because if we didn't have employers employing them sanction-free, there'd be no immigrant problem where everybody talks about they're taking our jobs. It's not the immigrants, it's the employers that are employing them. But about all the very, the thing, you know, they're just people and they're here to better their lives like we were. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she is a scholar and a true advocate for, you know, for progressive causes. I'm very much looking forward to speaking with her. We will have David Weisenfeld with us, a trial lawyer, a mediator, a Harvard Law grad, and just an overall nice guy and a mensch, who will talk to us about, you know, the challenges and pitfalls of bringing cases in court and what you may want to do as an alternative. And we will have Mark Leibowitz with us, who is a prominent entertainment lawyer who just had a film in the Cannes Film Festival that he executive produced, and he's a progressive entertainment lawyer with very humorous, and will have a lot of funny tales to tell us, and hopefully enliven our program and give us some information that we can use. So we are looking forward to the next few weeks. You can find me in the interim on Twitter at Jack Tuckner, and you can visit us at womensrightsny.com. And I did, while I have a couple of minutes, I'll just say this. There was a show in the 50s, and this show was on while Deborah and I were alive. I mean, you know, our young listeners wouldn't even know this, that's why it's important to know. There was a show called Queen for a Day, one of the most popular television shows of the 50s. Five times a week, three women, each with a hard luck story, recited their tales of woe about diseases, retarded children, poverty, and the studio audience, with the aid of an applause meter,
yes,
would then decide which woman had the greater misfortune. And what did she become when she had the greatest misfortune? Queen for a day. What did it mean? The Bailey, this guy Jack Bailey, who was a former carnival barker, put a crown on her head, wrapped her in a mink coat, which he got to keep for a day, 24 hours, told her about the new caddy she'd get to drive, also just for the next 24 hours. Then the queen was presented with gifts, a year's supply of Helena Rubinstein cosmetics, a Clairol permanent, and a once-over by a Hollywood makeup artist, and the electric appliances necessary for female happiness, a toaster oven, an automatic washer, and a dryer. Have to have the washer and dryer, automatic, and an iron. The gifts provided everything a woman needed to be a prettier and better housewife. One woman in the television audience was Betty Friedan, a 1942 honors graduate of Smith College and former psychology PhD candidate at the University of California, Berkeley. Friedan had quit grad school, married, moved to the New York suburbs, bore three children in rapid succession. But American culture told her that her husband, house, children, and electric appliances were true happiness, except that Friedan was not happy. And she was not alone. In 1957, Friedan sent out questionnaires to fellow members of her college graduating class. And the upshot is that, because we have 60 seconds left, I will tell you, she published in Red Book an article entitled Why Young Mothers Feel Trapped, and asked for examples of this problem. And she received 24,000 replies in very quick succession. And that was in 1963, she published the answer to her own answer to her own question in the book The Feminine Mystique, still a classic, still recommended for young, you know, women in their teens or 20s these days. It was one of the most influential books ever written by an American, and it helped to launch a new movement for women's liberation. So this book touched a nerve, but the origins of the movement lay in the role of females in American society. So perhaps in the future we will discuss the history of women's liberation.
Yes, I think we
so
should make the Feminine Mystique, you know, an assignment, and let's talk about
we
it.
We should,
next
and
week.
Maybe we can get Betty Friedan on. Is she still alive? I don't know. We'll look that up. Maybe we should know that. Anyway, until then, next week, this is Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell signing out and saying, we know it's precarious out there. It is extremely difficult, but keep your faith and don't quit. And we'll see you next Monday at 5 p.m.